Good morning, everyone. Fine Sunday morning here. It's Sunday, February 20th, 2011. Today's installment of the Politics of Exclusion in Judaism is Rabbi Dr. David Berger versus Chabad Lubavitch. We're doing this now, even though we're skipping a bit chronologically. In next week's, we're going to go back and write, and we're going to learn a lot more about response. I figured it was important to do it this week because, as we'll see at the end, we're going to contrast a little of Dr. Berger's objections to Chabad, or at least Messianic Chabad, versus, say, the Vilna Gaon's against Chassidut in general. It's something to keep in mind that I think there's enough of I think it's an interesting enough distinction to make. So first, by way of introduction, on June 12, 1994, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the seventh and to date final Lubavitcher Rebbe, passed away. You heard that right. He passed away. Rabbi Dr. David Berger, who's a scholar, historian, with an interest predominantly, or as far as I know, in Jewish-Christian relations in the Middle Ages, responded to the messianic trends in Chabad Lubavitch after his passing. So a few words about Rabbi Dr. Berger, as I believe he got his smicha from YU, MA and PhD from Columbia University. Predominantly, as I said, a historian, the class that I took with him in Revel was on Jewish-Christian polemic in the Middle Ages. After the Lubavitcher Rebbe passed away and certain things came out, there were friends of mine, or I shouldn't say friends of mine, there was, I guess, among, as you would say, the riffraff or the hamonam, or, you know, amongst people, some people were making an analogy that how Chabad is, or I shouldn't say, how elements in Chabad were responding to the Rebbe's passing was very similar to how the Christians responded to the death of Jesus. And if anyone was going to make that argument and do it well, it was going to be David Berger, because that's his field. This is what he spends a lot of time doing. For one point of clarification here, when we talk about Chabad Lubavitch and Mashiach, the Messiah, Messianic element, I want to make an important distinction here, and we'll see it explicitly in Dr. Berger's writings later on. There's a whenever I use the term Chabad in this case, or Chabad Lubavitch, I'm referring specifically to Messianic Chabad. I don't want to get into how much of Chabad believes the Rebbe is Mashiach. For our intents and purposes, that question doesn't matter. All that matters is that there is an element that at least existed back then. I don't know to what extent it's prevalent today, but certainly at the time Dr. Berger wrote this book, there was an element that was very vocal about the Rebbe being Mashiach. And it's important to realize that, you know, it's not that what he's writing, what we're talking about, is against Chabad in general as an institution. We're talking specifically about the messianic element in Chabad. It doesn't matter how big they are. It doesn't matter if you think that it's really prevalent today and they're just keeping it quiet. Irrelevant. All that matters is it did exist in at least one point in their history. We have evidence for that. And we're just going to take that at face value. So we're not going to, again, don't say, well, all Chabad really believes this. I'm not going to even touch that. All right? So that's just one by way of disclaimer. Today we're going to be discussing Dr. Berger's book that Ed actually brought in a copy of, called The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. You should know in the source sheets, in the very last page, I included a bibliography, so you don't need to jot down everything. It's all there. I included Dr. Berger's book. I included critiques and responses, meaning there were some people who didn't like what he had to say. In one case I found online where Dr. Berger responded to someone, and further reading. So you don't need to, you know, make sure you get everything. Most of the citations here are from Dr. Berger's book. All pagination is relative to his book. All right? All right, keeping that in mind here. So before we get to Dr. Berger's core argument against Messianic Chabad, it's important to review at least excerpts of two parts of Rambam that feature heavily in his discussion. Ed, could you take us with source number one, since it is pretty long, just do the underlying pieces.
If a king will arise in the house of David who diligently contemplates the Torah and observes its mitzvot as prescribed by the written law and the oral law, as David, his ancestor, compels all of Israel to walk in the way of the Torah, and rectify the breaches in its observance and fights the wars of God, we may with assurance consider him Mashiach.
All right, so this is Rambam Hilchot Malachim 11:4. First statement that he makes is, if this is a person who, you know, is righteous, does what he's supposed to, fights wars of God, you can consider him the Mashiach. But consider, important distinction in the next one, go ahead.
If he succeeds in the above, builds the temple in its place, and gathers the dispersed of Israel, he is definitely the Mashiach.
Correct. So we have a distinction here between who are people you could consider as possibilities versus who are people that you absolutely know for certain. According to Rambam in Hilchot Malachim 11:4, there's one criteria for people to say, all right, you might, you know, you could be considered.
I might be the Mashiach. Yeah.
No. So read the, skip a paragraph, read to the next underlined segment.
If he did not succeed to the degree or was killed, he surely is not the Redeemer promised by the Torah. Rather, he should be considered as all the proper and exemplary kinds of the Davidic dynasty who died. God caused him to arise only to test the man, as Daniel 11:35 states, and some of the wise men will stumble to try them to refine and to clarify until the appointed time, because the set time is in the future.
All right, so stop there. So I should also just include here that the translation here is from the Tuger Mishneh Torah. Did not come up with the translation on my own. Thus, I put in that citation there. So Rambam has three criteria. One, you've got one criteria for people you can consider Mashiach. Two, if he does everything he's supposed to, you know for certain he's the Mashiach. Three, if he didn't do everything he was supposed to, or he died, then you know for certain he's not the Mashiach.
Right?
Very simple criteria. So something to keep in mind of when someone is alive and he's doing all these great things, you can say, wow, he could be the Mashiach. Right? But if he doesn't, or once you know for certain that he doesn't, then you can't take him as Mashiach anymore. Alright? Turn the page to source number 2. This is Hilchot Malachim 12:2. Dana, could you read the underlying parts?
There are some sages who say that Elijah's coming, who say that Elijah's coming of Mashiach.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I must have missed something there. Probably heralds in the Mashiach.
Okay. All these and similar matters cannot be definitely known by man until they occur, for these matters are undefined in the prophet's words, and even the wise men have no established tradition regarding these matters except their own interpretation of the verses. Therefore, there is a controversy among them regarding these matters.
Yeah, continue.
It looks like
regardless of the debate concerning these questions, neither the order of the occurrence of these events or their precise detail are among the fundamental principles of the faith. A person should not occupy himself with the Agadah and the exegesis of the verses concerning these and similar matters, nor should he consider them as essentials, for the study of them will neither bring fear or love of God.
So Rambam, despite having criteria in Hilchot Malachim 11:4 about what Mashiach is supposed to do or not supposed to do, he also says that when you're talking about, you know, what's supposed to happen in terms of leading up to the Mashiach, it's entirely speculative. We don't know. And there isn't a clear tradition as to what's going to happen, but you'll know it when you know it, or at least according to Rambam, if this individual accomplishes certain goals, performs certain tasks, only then, after the fact, can you know for certain he's Mashiach. But don't spend too much time thinking about it, because it's not very helpful. Yeah.
I experienced that. I'm curious whether you've also experienced this, that certain class rabbis and pulpit rabbis kind of looked at the events of the day and said, we're certainly in the time of Mashiach.
Yeah.
Is that against us?
It's hard to say. From the perspective of a rabbi, I can tell you this. It is not uncommon for rabbis to engage in hyperbole.
No kidding.
Okay. When I was in Gross, Wayuz Kolel in Israel, in 2001 to 2002, and there was a gentleman who was a computer programmer who was laid off, so he was learning in the base midrash, until he could find another job. And he was studying with Kabbalists who, swore up and down, this is the war to end all wars. And me being me, I was like, all right, fine. And he was like kind of annoyed that I was being so nonchalant about it. My take was, what's the big deal? Like, if it is, it is. If not, like, you obviously can't know for certain. Yeah, this happens. And the truth is, when people talk about the Messiah, it's something that people like talking about. It's like, Mashiach is coming in, end of days. It's something that strikes at the core of religious emotion. So you can see why, pulpit rabbis would talk about this sort of thing. Is it going against Rambam? Possibly, but let's face it, a lot of people go against Rambam in a whole lot of things. Right? Like I said on numerous occasions that if we actually followed Rambam consistently, we would have a very different practical Judaism than we do today. Very different. So, point is, Rambam is saying that it's speculative, and you can understand why these two statements of Rambam could be seen as mutually contradictory. Where on one hand he's saying, here's what Mashiach is going to do, and on the other hand he says, we're not entirely certain as to how things are going to operate.
Yeah.
One of the points that Dr. Berger makes is, in previous failed messianic movements in Judaism, as long as the guy was still alive, they would quote the first Rambam we cited as saying, he's so good, this is all the stuff he's going to do. Once he dies, they say he was the Mashiach, and then they quote the second one of like, we don't really know what happened. And he gave a few examples of that. And it's important to keep that in mind, just from a pragmatic perspective of, if you're going to hang your hat on the Rambam in terms of Mashiach, which people do for some reason, of saying, by for some reason, I mean, since he acknowledges it is speculative, it's hard to say why Rambam on Mashiach is in any way objectively better than anyone else, but people like hanging their hat on the Rambam, but it gives them a little bit of leeway to do so selectively. When it fits one goal, they'll quote one Rambam. When it fits another goal, they'll quote another Rambam. Not unlike how people treat the Rambam from a halachic perspective. You cite the Rambam when he says what you want to say, and when he says stuff you don't want to say, we don't pass him like the Rambam. All right? But it's important to keep these two ideas in mind. All right? So we turn to page 4 in the source sheets. Here on out, all but one of the citations are from Dr. Berger's book, The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. For the actual page numbers, they're in parentheses at the end. Feel free to check me up on this. Another great reason why I like this topic is because our primary source of the objection to Messianic Chabad is written completely in English, which makes our life a whole lot easier. And, also because Dr. Berger is alive, thank God, and he is incredibly responsive to emails or to critiques, more than most people, you're free to have a discussion with him. Instead of us resorting to speculation, as we had in previous texts and scholarship, this is contemporary enough that, we can still handle it, and we can still talk to the author.
And also he's modest. He doesn't call himself rabbi. He calls himself doctor.
He's a very sweet person, too. Yeah.
Throughout the history, has anybody attempted to define Mashiach, sources, when he would come? How would you know that the Mashiach is here?
Well, Rambam did. He said, once he's done all this, this is how you know. So there you go.
That's what you missed.
All right, so on page number 4, the way that I broke down this book, I just want to, a few discussions about the book itself. He acknowledges in the introduction, he's writing it as a memoir. It's not an academic book in the sense that he's not writing it from a dispassionate view. This is something that Dr. Berger really cares about, and for him to get this worked up, like, really says something if you know him personally. This is not an academic book. It's him writing from his own personal perspective. There are a lot of citations in the book. One chapter is an article that he wrote for Jewish Action, which is the OU's magazine, which he reprinted. I think there was chapter 2 in the book. So it's not a normal book in the sense of thesis statement, arguments, proofs. So the things that I'm quoting it from the book are a little bit out of order, but I think will provide us, I don't think it's out of context. And again, all the page numbers there are cited. So if anyone objects to how I've cited, you know, please let me know. References are all here. I try to restructure it in a way that will give us a little more logical coherency for the purpose of having our discussion on the politics of exclusion, which we've been talking about is what is it that they're doing that is so... Well, first off, what is it that they're doing? Two, why is what they're doing so wrong? Those are the two main questions that we're trying to address here, at least according to the thought of Dr. David Berger. All right? Sharon, could you take source number three? This is in a section of statements from Chabad Lubavitch on the Rebbe's messiahship. Or, yeah, go ahead.
For me, the first indication that belief in the Rebbe's messiahship has had withstood his demise came 4 or 5 days later when I saw a full-page advertisement in the Jewish press advertising an afternoon-long event to be held on on Sunday, June 19, 1994, precisely a week after the Rebbe's death. The text ended, quote, "With broken hearts, we affirm our faith that we will at once witness Tachias Chamesim,
the resurrection of the dead. Yeah.
And we will have the Rebbe lead us out of Golis exile immediately, and together we will continue to proclaim, may our master, teacher, and rabbi, the King Messiah, live forever."
This was a statement that was very prevalent towards, you know, while the Rebbe was still alive. You had the messianic element within Chabad was very prominent when the Rebbe was still alive. Where Dr. Berger is concerned here is what happens after the Rebbe dies. Okay? If you're following the Rambam, if someone is alive and you want to say someone is Mashiach, well, you know, Rambam says, you know, at the top, like, okay, you know, you can, he might fit certain characteristics, not a big deal. Or you can say, well, he's not the Mashiach, but again, it's all speculative until he does certain things. However, where Dr. Berger is particularly concerned here isn't saying that the Rebbe is Mashiach when he's alive. It's continuing to say the Rebbe is Mashiach after he dies. Meaning he wrote this book not when the Rebbe was alive, but after he died in response to how people were treating the Lubavitch Rebbe after his death. Yeah.
I went to the Midtown Chabad for a Purim thing after he died.
Yeah.
Years after he died. They still stick in stuff about the Mashiach in the davening. At the end of the Amida, or at the end of the...
When you say second stuff about the Mashiach, it's one thing to pray for Mashiach. It's another thing to assert that the Rebbe is Mashiach.
My Hebrew isn't that good, so I don't know. But I got a feeling they're trying to say, you know...
I have to see. Again, I'm not going to comment on how much it's prevalent. The citation here, right, you have a public ad that's still attesting to the Rebbe as Mashiach a week after he died.
Yeah.
Okay, and this was in 94.
Like them or don't, Chabad doesn't insert anything in their davening about the Rebbe being Mashiach.
Right, and also, I should point out something very crucial here that makes this a little bit, that sort of distinguishes Chabad messianism from previous messianic groups, in that, to my knowledge, the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself, or by Menachem Mendel Schneerson, when he was alive, never explicitly said, "I am the Mashiach."
But he never denied it.
There are questions as to him denying it, how much he knew, how much he didn't know. I know that he suffered a stroke. I don't know how much he was with it to really understand what was going on in his name. I can't speak for him, but the fact that he didn't say that he is the Mashiach is, I think, important enough in its own right. Because what you're discussing here isn't the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, as a megalomaniac. You've got followers that could have imposed upon him a significance that he might not have considered himself. And I think that's a very important distinction between this and other messianic movements. All right? Yeah.
How long after Schneerson passed away?
Yeah.
Was the book written?
The book was written 6 years later, but it was a compilation of a lot of things. When he's concluding this, right, this is the ad that's cited here is in 94. He had written an article for Jewish Action that came out. I have the citation here in terms of 1995. is when he wrote the Jewish Action article, and he kind of, my understanding is he kind of wrote the book, you know, a few years later once he compiled enough material, because the subheading of the book is The Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. What Dr. Berger found so incredulous is, for him, it should be obvious that this messianic element of Chabad, I mean, the ones who still say the Rebbe is Mashiach after he died, should have been completely ostracized from the Jewish community, and yet, for the most part, the Orthodox community didn't care, which is why, you know, had that subject of the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference, right? So he's writing this a few years later because, despite the arguments, what he sees as this is just so blatantly, like, false, and we'll see his arguments a little bit later in detail, no one's paying attention.
Is the argument that Knesset's has that become stronger, remain the same in the
community? No idea. I have no idea. I'm not in Chabad. I can't speak for them,
because,
and I won't speak for them.
If that was dying out or becoming less significant, even if had to write the book.
I don't know. What I can say is this. Remembering how things were in, say, 94, 95, the overt messianic rhetoric has definitely been toned down. Now, does that mean that people are, you know, don't believe he's the Mashiach anymore? No, it just means they're not as vocal about it. And this is just what I'm saying as an outsider. Back then, you saw it all over the place. Today, not as much. That's the only thing that I can see just from my experience. All right? Again, take number four here. Yeah.
Just a question. I mean,
sure.
This is sort of tangential. This is not a course on messianism.
Mm-hmm.
But we never really discussed in any of these cases, Shabtai Tzvi, or what made people believe that any of these people were the Mashiach? On what grounds?
To answer that from a very general phenomenological perspective, if you're coming out from a very difficult situation and you've been trained to think like the end of the days eschatology in any way, the study of the end of days is something that's very attractive to people, because at the end, and no pun intended there, the whole point of eschatology is the ultimate validation of everything that you've believed in and all the struggles you went through up until that point. It's why you have Christians who will still talk about the upcoming rapture, right? And they'll say it's coming up. Why? Because when the rapture happens, in their mind, it will show a public revelation that our religion was correct. So you can see why, if someone says, I'm the Mashiach, you want to get in on the ground floor, because, like, you know, you want to be one of the first people to show your faith. And you can understand just the attraction on a very lay level of, you know, end of times are coming, it's all coming to a head, and you're a part of this major, you know, a major, if not the most, the major instance of your religion in modern day. Yeah.
Isn't it kind of more in keeping with Halacha to be a little bit skeptical and say, we'll see, let's see if you fulfill the whole...
Is it more in line with Halacha? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know, but I can...
Maybe not.
Well, because I'm not going to paskin as to what it is that you can or can't believe, should or shouldn't believe. Or at least, I'm not going to do it today. What I can say is that since you're talking not about a rational argument, you're talking about emotional religious fervor, the logic and reason of Halacha is not going to enter into the discussion. Right? Because you're just getting caught up in the moment. And if you have people who, let's say, don't have, you know, a textual background, you know, they're just a pashut yid. They, you know, like going to work, they like davening, you know, that basically if they hear, you know, Dvar Torah from their rabbi every now and again, it gives them a sense of being part of a greater whole. Yes, there's a psychology involved in that too. That's, yeah.
Well,
one last comment on this, and then we want to move on, because there's just a whole lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's my understanding with some of the past false messiahs, you could understand in a time of enormous pressure on the people, at a time of desperation, the need for a messiah.
Yeah.
I don't see that we live in a time that would turn the Chabad to feel that way.
Possibly. I understand that. Meaning, if you have, say, Shabtai Tzvi or Frank, that might have developed after certain massacres in Europe. Say,
maybe you got Ahmadinejad. Maybe that will trigger a new...
But Ahmadinejad came, you know, really was a political force much longer, you know, much later after the Rebbe died. Mm-hmm. So he wouldn't necessarily have been a figure. But let's look at it internally in Chabad itself and Chassidut in a very abstract level. Chassidut is dependent on the Rebbe. And the Rebbe did not pick a successor. He had no children, which meant you didn't have a normal line of succession. When the Rebbe passed away, it wasn't just an issue of, like, oh, we're worried about some big event in the world, but it was a big event within the world of Chabad, because you lost that chain of Rebbeim. There's been no replacement Lubavitcher Rebbe since. And when you have a Hasidic movement without a Rebbe, kind of difficult. I mean, I've seen Rebbes without Hasidim. I'm not going to mention the person's name, but I actually do know of, like, there's, when I was in Israel with my cousins, they said, oh, you know, this is a such and such a Rebbe. And I said, oh, where is Hasidim? He doesn't have any. It's like, okay, fine. You know, I've definitely seen that, but, like, whatever. But to be a Hasid without a Rebbe is very difficult. So it might not have been a global trauma. It might not have been a globally Jewish, a trauma that was just globally Jewish, but it definitely was for Chabad themselves. We're moving on. Source number four here on page four. Source number four. Yeah.
Days after the Rebbe's death, a messianist newspaper in Israel compared non-believers to the worshippers of the golden calf who lost faith because Moses was absent one day longer than had been anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
5 months later, a more moderate publication of Israeli believers pointed to Rambam, who had, after all, set forth, quote, a great principle that with respect to these matters, no one knows how they will happen until they happen, end quote. The point, of course, is not to cast doubt on the Rebbe's messiahship, but to blunt the force of his death. Shabtai Tzvi's prophet had cited the same Maimonidean passage after his hero's apostasy. Once again, the great medieval rationalist was mobilized to defend a failed messianic mission.
Yeah. Direct quote again from Dr. Berger here. So I included these two sources here where he's citing sources after the Rebbe's death where they are trying to maintain this idea that the Rebbe is Mashiach even after he died. And in the second source, in source number four here, you see explicitly how he is responding. They are responding by quoting the Rambam. He, again, discusses this at length. It's a very big book. I only took out excerpts. All right. So including these here, two statements. There were more, but these were at least published. By published, I mean part of the public record. It's very hard to footnote conversations. Once you have some, and I give Dr. Berger a lot of credit here, I give him a lot of credit for how he wrote this book, because certain times he's just very explicit, but he's not relying on hearsay. He's relying on actual things that were published for public dissemination, and that's what he's basing a lot of his statements on. Right, not just speculation here. So these are just two instances of statements that came from Chabad Lubavitch sources attesting to the Rebbe's messiahship after he died. Where things get, I think, a little bit more dicey is, let's say you even think that they've got an incorrect view of the Mashiach. It gets a little more complicated when you start saying that the Rebbe had divine characteristics. Which we see in what I have here on section B on page 4. Continue.
Okay.
Move on, questions. Page source number 5 here.
In the autumn of 1996, the Israeli weekly Shahat
HaGeulah, the conversation of the redemption,
Printed a revised version of the standard messianic slogan, which read, "May our master, teacher, and creator," instead of the Rebbe, "the king messiah, live forever," and a few weeks later declared that it was permissible to bow to the Rebbe because his entire essence is divinity alone.
So in 1995, you know, so let's say 2 years after his death, you don't just find Yechi Adonenu Moreinu V'Rabbeinu, right, you know, long live the King Messiah. They add in this world, Uboreinu, our creator, right? So you're not just saying that the Rebbe is Mashiach, you're saying that the Rebbe is God, or God-like, or some God-based derivative. Right?
You can't be a God-based derivative and be the creator.
Well, whatever. However, look, again, not being a theologian, I'm you know, trying to mute it a bit, and I also just like that turn of phrase. Source number six here. The most elaborate of the spate of writings affirming the Rebbe's divinity appeared in English in an August 1996 issue of Beis Mashiach, a lengthy weekly journal with substantial circulation in which mainstream messianist figures regularly participate. The author, a layman with a doctoral degree, set forth his Jewish theology. A certain Lubavitcher rabbi was chiding a certain Lubavitcher chassid about his continuing faith in the Rebbe as Melech HaMashiach, the King Messiah. So we're talking again in 96, 2 years after the Rebbe died. The chassid bit the bait, and in the ensuing banner commented that if the Rebbe was wrong, then all chassidism is disqualified all the way back to the Baal Shem Tov. The Rav became serious and said, "No, my friend, all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Rabbi." So being stuck with Moshe Rabbeinu means being stuck with the Rebbe, which means being stuck with the absolute truth of all their statements, including those statements about what is Rebbe. For example, that Rebbe is the, quote, essence and being of God enclosed in a body, unquote. That a Rebbe by nature is, quote, omniscient and omnipotent. That all material and spiritual blessings flow from the Rebbe. So who is Elokeinu, our God? Who Avinu, our Father? Who Malkeinu, who Moshienu? Who Yoshienu Vigalenu Shemit Bekarov? Who will save and redeem us once again shortly? The Rebbe Melech HaMoshiach. That's who. You really don't get a statement as explicit like this, where he's basically saying the Rebbe is God. Ed, take number 7 for us on page 5.
On the third anniversary of the Rebbe's death, a full-page advertisement appeared in the New York Times declaring that the third of Tammuz is not the Rebbe's yard site, a word denoting the anniversary of an ordinary human being's demise. In this case, we were informed the date marks the time when the Rebbe was liberated from the limitations of corporeal existence.
Mm-hmm.
In the absence of such limitations, he is accessible to all of us, everywhere, at any time. Anyone, however great or humble, can turn to him with their deepest prayers. There are no barriers. There is no need to make a pilgrimage or stand in line to receive his blessing. Amazing stories keep pouring in from all corners of the globe. People are experiencing miracles, large and small. And all this because of a personal connection to the Rebbe who is with all of us.
And New this York is what Times. They're writing in the New York Times.
Which
right?
is a secular paper?
Well, not just a secular paper, but it shows that, look, I don't know who actually paid for this, but it does show that...
Oh, it's an advertisement. Don't print anything.
No, but I understand that. The question is, were the people who paid for the advertisement speaking in the name of all of Chabad Lubavitch, or was it, say, a particularly wealthy donor who did it on a certain behalf?
Gotcha.
My point is, or I shouldn't say my point, really Dr. Berger's point, I believe, in citing this, because after all, we're all citing him, is that this was prevalent enough that someone made a conscious decision to disseminate this view of the Lubavitcher Rebbe in a public forum. It's one thing to say, you might say, well, how they write internally is one thing, but this is the New York Times. And they're saying how he was liberated from the limitations of corporeal existence?
This is crystal entropy.
Which is exactly what Berger argues. As kind of I introduced it, people made analogies to that. But in terms of anyone who could do it well, if not, I hesitate to use the term gravitas, but certainly the bona fides to make that argument would be Dr. Berger, because his academic field is Jewish-Christian relations. He knows his stuff probably as well as anyone else. So if anyone from the Orthodox world is going to make a make an argument along these lines, it's only appropriate that Berger would be the one to do it. So at any rate, right, this part of the argument, you have some people in Chabad, or some messianic element in Chabad would be a better way of putting it, that says he's still the Messiah after he died. Another element that starts attributing characteristics of the divine to the Rebbe after he died. Okay? Which leads us to the next section of Berger's response. And I give him a great deal of credit for this statement alone, because he's just so explicit and direct. Doesn't beat around the bush here. Dana, source number 8 on page 5.
The primary objective of this book is to establish the principle that anyone who proclaims the messiahship of the Rebbe stands outside the parameters of Orthodox Judaism and must be treated accordingly.
Straightforward. I mean, after the Rebbe died, the point of his book, he's trying to convince you, that you're trying, he's trying to establish, and you know, why he's upset that Jews haven't already accepted this, because for him it's obvious, is simply, it, well, not as simply, but his point is, not against, again, he's not against Chabad. He is saying that whoever proclaims the messiahship of the Rebbe is outside the parameters of Orthodox Judaism. This is, I mean, for our class series here on the politics of exclusion, you don't get much better than just this one-line statement here, just very direct. It's very, well, it's not only is it strong, but it is just so explicit and blunt. There's no beating around the bush here. The problem isn't with Chabad, according to Bergen. I think that's a very important point to keep in mind. It's specifically claiming that the Rebbe is Mashiach after he dies. Due to his insistence, he actually got the source number 9, which is from the application to the Rabbinical Council of America. He got this included in the application. I include it here because it's publicly available on their website. Sharon, please read source number 9 here.
RCA application, affirmation regarding Messianic belief. By checking this box and putting my signature below, I affirm that the following resolution adopted at the RCA's 1996 annual convention reflects my beliefs. In light of disturbing developments which have recently arisen in the Jewish community, the Rabbinical Council of America, in convention assembled, declares that there is not and never has been a place in Judaism for the belief that Mashiach ben David will begin his messianic mission only to experience death, burial, and resurrection before completing it. Unquote.
This is the only statement in the RCA application where I would call, say, a loyalty oath, where you actually have to affirm a particular statement of theology. Now, being part of the RCA and having joined after 96, you know, I agree. I mean, as uncomfortable as I am signing to, you know, things like that, it's like, here's what I have to believe. I agreed with the statement because you just don't find that anywhere. But you can see exactly what he's responding to. And why he felt it was necessary to put this in for, you know, for future generations or for future rabbis. So to some degree, kind of succeeded, at least in convincing the Rabbinical Council of America to take it seriously enough not to accept into the RCA not only not to accept anyone into the RCA who believes the Rebbe is Mashiach, but compelling people who want to join the RCA to explicitly deny the fundamental principles underlying Messianic Chabad, or at least contemporary Messianic Chabad. Okay? So, what's his argument? Dan, take source number 10 here. And by his argument, I mean, yes, it's very nice. Here's what Chabad said. Here's what Berger wants to do. What is his basis, or what is his rationale for trying to convince people that anyone who proclaims the messiahship of the Rebbe stands outside the parameters of Orthodox Judaism? Right. So that was his thesis statement, which he includes on, say, page 117 of his book. The rest of this section here will deal with what are the reasons that would lead someone to this conclusion. All right. Source number 10 here.
As I write, two propositions from which every mainstream Jew in the last millennium would have instantly recoiled have become legitimate options within Orthodox Judaism. One, a specific descendant of King David may be identified with certainty as the Messiah, even though he died in an unredeemed world. The criteria always deemed necessary for confident identification of the Messiah, the temporal redemption of the Jewish people, a rebuilt temple, peace and prosperity, the universal recognition of the God of Israel, are null and void. Two, the Messianic faith of Judaism allows for the following scenario. God will finally send the true Messiah to embark upon his redemptive mission. The long-awaited Redeemer will declare that all preparations for the redemption have been completed and announce without qualification that the fulfillment is absolutely imminent. He will begin the process of gathering the dispersed of Israel to the Holy Land. He will proclaim himself a prophet, point clearly to his Messianic status, and declare that the only remaining task is to greet him as the Messiah. And then he will die and be buried without having redeemed the world. To put the matter more succinctly, the true Messiah's redemptive mission, publicly proclaimed and vigorously pursued, will be interrupted by death and burial, and then consummated through a second coming.
Yeah, sound familiar?
Christianity.
Bingo.
It's almost frightful.
That is exactly his argument, and why he's so, like, I mean, first off, two points that I'd like to mention here. One is exactly as you said, he praised it as such intentionally, to make those comparisons to Christianity very apparent, that never, his argument is, never before in Judaism, and this is, you know, the second, well, I forget the number of points. I'll have to redo the source sheet, you know, for putting it online, but I would underline the line here that says the criteria always deemed necessary for confident identification of the Messiah. What does it mean, always deemed necessary? He's basing it on Rambam, but his assumption behind it is, well, Jews have always argued this sort of thing here. Right? What does always deemed necessary mean? In particular, then you get to the second point, and I think where he's coming from, when you go back, since he spent a lot of academic effort and research with, say, disputations with Catholics, I mean, not him, but like, you know, Catholics versus Jews in the Middle Ages in particular, or Christians and Jews in the Middle Ages, you know, he knows that, you know, for so many years, like, the how the Jews defended themselves against Christianity was, well, the fact that Jesus didn't accomplish everything that he was supposed to do proves that he wasn't the Mashiach, right? So once you start saying, oh, he started it but had to stop in the middle because he died and he's going to come back, was really the Christian argument as to why Jesus was the Messiah. He actually includes an interesting story of a couple of rabbis who were on a train, and the topic of Bar Kokhba came up. Debating with a Christian, and someone asked, well, you know, he asked the Christian, how do you know that Bar Kokhba wasn't the Mashiach? And I said, well, he died. There you go. You know, sort of like QED. The fact that Bar Kokhba died without doing stuff, you know, shows that he wasn't the Mashiach. Same analogy to say Jesus. Well, Jesus died. So then you say, no, wait, maybe he didn't really die. Yeah.
So we still have Eliyahu HaNavi in the running because he didn't die. Right.
We, again, Rambam says that's all speculative.
Yeah. Right. So I'm saying he's in the running. I'm not saying he's the guy.
Well, how do you know? He went, according to the Navi, he, you know, went up to heaven. As far as whether or not he died, I haven't the foggiest idea what that means.
Okay.
You know. Okay. Let's turn the page. I'm going to have to reorganize some of these sources here. Where are we up to reading wise?
11.
No. I mean people. Like, who's last source?
George.
Okay, George. Please read source number 13, and I have to take out 14 because that was incorrect. Yeah, I have to renumber this. Yeah, so if you happen to be listening to this online, follow along with the words. I'm going to have to move some stuff around, might take some stuff out, and the numbers from this point on might not be consistent. So try to keep up with the source sheets if you're listening to this later. Yeah, so read source number 13.
From the Jewish Messianism, Passing Phenomenon or Turning Point in the History of Judaism, originally published in Jewish Action, fall of 1995, I believe with complete faith in the coming of the Messiah, and even though he may tarry, I await him each day, hoping that he will come.
Mm-hmm. Continue with the next source. It shouldn't be a separate one. They're all connected.
This version of Rambam's 12th principle of Judaism has served as a source of faith and consolation for generations.
Consolidation
for generations of Jews. And in Christian,
or could be consolation. I have to check the if I didn't make a typo. Yeah.
And in Christian countries, as a central affirmation of the resistance to the belief in the messianship of Jesus. During the past year, we have witnessed a profound transformation in the understanding of this principle by a major movement located well within the parameters of Orthodox Judaism. This may be a passing phenomenon, but it may also mark the significant moment in the history of the Jewish religion. The more convinced Jews are that it is the former, the more likely it is to become the latter.
What are you worried about?
No, nothing. No. Okay, it's consolidation. Sorry, just wanted to check to make sure I got it.
It's consolidation.
It's, yeah. All right, so the more convinced Jews are, the reformers more likely to become the latter. Source, what's listed here is 15, because all of this seems so strange to outsiders. Many observers cannot bring themselves to see the truth. The dominant elements among Hasidim in the major Lubavitch population centers of Crown Heights in Brooklyn and Kfar Chabad in Israel, perfectly normal people representing a highly successful, very important Jewish movement, believe that Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson will return from the dead, are from places of concealment, and lead the world into redemption. Ed, take number 16.
Along with Sabbateanism and Christianity, this movement has survived the death of its Messiah. Although it has much in common with its two predecessors, it is also significantly different. And some of the differences, particularly Kabat's commitment to observing all the mitzvot and the character of its messianic figure, still entitle us to use the word lahavdil in comparing these movements. At the same time, the similarities are so striking and the issue so critical that we have no right to mince words in drawing analogies. A summary comparison then should provide a useful overview.
Right, so right now in this next section here, he's giving you similarities between the Messianic Chabad's response to the Rebbe's passing and to Christianity's Sabbateanism and core differences between them. So go ahead.
Among the similarities, the creation of new grounds for belief in response to apparent failure.
Right, to stop there for a second, right? So do we understand what that point is? By creating new grounds for belief in response to apparent failure means you thought that he was going to be the Mashiach because you expect him to do X, Y, and Z. Since he didn't do what you thought he was going to do, you then reinvent or you recategorize what the Mashiach is supposed to do to keep this person in line with your a priori assumption that he is the Mashiach. Right, two.
Faith in an immediate return, which is then postponed.
Right, so you expect him to come back. It's supposed to be ASAP, and the longer that you wait, the longer you tarry, just means that you have to have more faith that eventually he is going to come.
The citation of evidence from biblical sources, and in the case of Sabbateanism and Lubavitch, from rabbinic literature as well.
So after he passed away, when the Rebbe was still alive, you had Chabad that was were citing verses to say support the assumption that the Rebbe was Mashiach, and then after he passed away, they started citing not only verses to say here's why the Rebbe is Mashiach, but like Sabbateanism, which was from Jewish sources, in particular, they were also citing rabbinic sources as to, hey, here's why according to Torah Shabbat Al-Peh, he's supposed to be he's supposed to be the Mashiach. Okay.
The appeal of Sabbateans and Lubavitch Hasidim to Rambam's affirmation of ignorance regarding details of the messianic process,
which we discussed earlier.
The belief held by some, but not all messianists, that the messianic figure is not really dead at all.
Which we saw in the New York Times thing of you don't say it's a yahrzeit, because how could it be a yahrzeit if he didn't really die?
Is that true of Elvis Presley as well?
Possibly. Alright, so among the differences, so here's how characteristics of the messianic movement within Chabad that distinguish it from previous messianic movements, including Christianity. Go ahead.
The exceptional qualifications of the Rebbe.
So you could say this is, he thinks that it's like, well, the Rebbe, by all accounts, good person. Unlike Shabtai Tzvi, didn't really do anything that abnormal, or at least according to Dr. Berger, that the Rebbe himself was a good enough person that while he was alive, maybe you could think it would be different. And also, as stated, continue.
The argument before the Rebbe's death, and in some circles even after it, that the skeptic is obligated to provide a superior candidate.
Meaning, as long as the Rebbe is alive, I say that the Rebbe is Mashiach, and you say he's not the Mashiach, then the burden would be on me to say, well, if you don't think he's the Mashiach, then who else is? Mm. The point is, this is one of the characteristics that differentiates Messianic Chabad from other Messianic movements. Whereas in other messianic movements, you're saying this person is the Messiah to the exclusion of every other person. At least here, they entertain the possibility that someone else could theoretically be, but the burden would be on you to prove someone else's. Meaning, you can't just get up and say he's not the Mashiach. You have to say, well, why not? Who else is?
It's also
which is loading the dice against the skeptic, because the skeptic is not obligated to find another candidate. You can just say this makes no sense.
Perhaps, but the fact that this argument existed shows that their approach to the Mashiach was qualitatively different than previous messianic movements.
Okay.
That's his point in this section here. Dana?
Skeptic is obligated to provide a superior candidate?
It's an argument, again, it's an argument that's provided by Chabad. Whether or not we agree with this statement, the fact that they included this as part of the discourse shows that it is different from previous messianic movements. That's all the statement means.
So they couldn't document an obligation. They're just making that up?
But the fact that they would even have that theoretical discussion shows that there's a difference. Or at least, okay?
Continue. The movement's viability in the absence of its messianic component.
All right, so if you take away the messianic measure of Chabad, they could still function, right? It's not, Chabad Lubavitch is not dependent on the Rebbe being Mashiach, whereas Sabbateanism would be. Christianity has to be, right? But Hasidus could theoretically continue, and you could argue that it has continued, taking away the messianic elements. Okay.
The belief in a Messiah who, unlike Shabbatai Tzvi, and perhaps unlike Jesus, never made a formal explicit declaration of his messiahship. Hence a movement that might be described as false messianism without a false messiah.
Right, here's the point that we made earlier. Right, to say, you know, if the guy, if the Lubavitcher Rebbe never said he was the Mashiach, right, so it's a very weird phenomena that you've got, as he put it, false messianism without a false messiah, because the Lubavitcher Rebbe never said he was Mashiach. Yeah?
The commitment to the full observance of Jewish law.
Now we can debate this point too about to what extent is Chabad actually consistent with Jewish law, because they do have their own Shulchan Aruch called Shulchan Aruch Arav. But at least in theory, they do say, well, you have to follow Jewish law. Right, it's not that, you know, the law is abrogated. Granted, in the Christian sources, there's a bit of an inconsistency with Jesus' own teachings. To what extent was the previous Torah abrogated versus you have to, not one dot would be removed. But for the most part, you know, they still believe in keeping halacha.
The availability of a vast library of videotapes which can preserve a sense of the departed Messiah's physical presence.
Right. So what would you think that having these recordings of the Rebbe would do to a movement, or at least an important phenomenological distinction between Chabad and everyone else?
They keep him alive artificially by saying, tune into this videotape.
Yeah.
There he is.
Exactly. Meaning, if you invested, to explain, if you invested so much emotional energy, let's say in Shabbat Tzvi or Jesus, and then he's no longer there, you have to do a lot more to recreate the significance of that individual in your life, because the person isn't there physically. Whereas with Chabad Lubavitch, the fact that the Rebbe passed away, right, even, you know, putting on the side of the messianic elements, because there's so much of him, and I don't just mean writings, I mean you can actually see him speak, you can actually hear him speak, this person directly, you don't necessarily need to go to the same extremes to keep this person alive in your historical memory, because he's there. Right? You've got better archives that you don't need to make stuff up about him, or at least you don't have the same emotional need to make stuff up about him, because he's still going to be more part of your life than other people who might have passed away with absolutely zero record. I think there are enough instances where if someone passes away, it's very easy to, you know, gloss over a lot of bad stuff that they did, because, you know, yeah, you just focus on the good and you ignore everything else. Not to say that the Rebbe did bad things, but you've the distinction being, like if you, how to put it, I'm going to try to give an example. Like let's say you take a rapper, right? You know, sometimes rappers are, you know, who might have been gunned down are, you know, really aggrandized after they died. Or for a modern example in the Jewish world, Shlomo Carlebach. The attitude of, you know, people who follow Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach these days, you know, have a certain view of him, which, you know, thinking back to some other things that happened, you know, when he was alive, you can say, well, if he did certain things now that he did then, he arguably could be in jail. Right? So the point being, you know, you could do a degree of historical revisionism, but when you do have certain tapes of certain things, you don't have to invent stuff. Because it's one thing to say, we're only going to look at the good parts and not look at the bad parts. It's another thing to say, well, we're just going to make up stories. When you have evidence, recorded, video or audio, about what someone says or how someone acts, you don't need to make stuff up about the person, because you've got it right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
But and it's also Jerry Garcia with a yarmulke.
Okay.
He's a musician, he's got followers, and he was turned into a lot more than...
But there isn't a religious element to Jerry Garcia.
Depends on who you ask.
No one that I've met. Let me leave it at that. And I don't think he... Well, anyway. But at least you can say that Jerry Garcia admits that he's dead. and grateful for.
Yes.
Anyway, and finally, the pluralistic environment. Being today, and here's a very important point to consider, the Jewish people on the whole are going to be more accepting of Chabad. You'll notice, right, you know, one of the ways I introduce it and why we're doing it this week after we discuss the Vilna Gaon versus Hasidut in general, is consider the different situations in which both arose. When the Vilna Gaon was bashing Chabad, when the Vilna Gaon was bashing Hasidut, Hasidut was a relatively new innovation. It, you know, was just springing up. It was something that hadn't been done before, and he was trying to nip it in the bud. Whereas Chabad has been around for quite some time. You could argue since the time of the Vilna Gaon, right? Being, you know, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the, you know, first Lubavitcher Rebbe. There you go. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, when this Messianic movement came out, Chabad Lubavitch as a whole, like not the Messianic element as a whole, is accepted as quote Orthodox by the Jewish community. And that's going to affect how people respond, and in this case, not for the better, according to Dr. Berger. Because since we're predisposed to have already accepted Chabad, since they've already proven a certain degree of legitimacy, it's sort of like you have to work even harder to delegitimize them. Whereas if a new movement comes out, and they haven't established themselves, it's very easy to dismiss them a priori, and like saying, you have to prove yourself. Chabad already proved itself through generations. Chabad is incredibly prolific. Chabad does a great deal of good that Dr. Berger, you know, writes about. You know, but the fact that it is so well accepted in normative Orthodox Judaism from, say, a cultural perspective as being legitimately Orthodox, and they've already have that approval by the Orthodox community, makes it a little bit more difficult, I think, also for Dr. Berger to start ostracizing them on any level.
Yeah. I would phrase this differently.
Okay.
And I like to think in analogies. If you have a house where all the walls are painted white, and one wall somehow gets yellow, then it really stands out, and mm-hmm. and it bothers you tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have rooms that are already different shades, and another room pops up another shade, it's not so serious. So I thought what he was saying was, in the time of the Vilna Gaon, there was only one Judaism. If another group popped up, you know, it was a real thorn in his side. But now there are so many stripes.
Yeah.
Some legitimate, some not so legitimate, some really not legitimate.
I think that's a completely valid point, 100%. I think the fact that we've already been accustomed to sectarianism, for lack of a better term, or if not sectarianism, denominationalism, the fact that Chabad has established itself as being sustainable, unique, Orthodox, even though it's not one of us, right? You know, by us I mean, let's say, modern Orthodox, or however you want to describe yourself, by us, anything that isn't Chabad, right? You know, which is, you know, a little bit more broader. I think that works just as well too. Yeah.
I want to just remark that the two shalichot of Lubavitch, who kind of, one you mentioned, Shlomo Kalbach, was one of the.
I don't know if you could really consider him a shalich of Chabad. I don't know enough about
and
that.
And Zalman Schachter, who's into like post-denominationalism.
I don't know enough about the comments specifically. Dana, take source number 17.
On 17 June 1994, 5 days after the Petira of the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
Yeah, I think he's including that in particular, specifically here. When you include Zatzal, Zechar Tzadik Levracha, you only write that for someone who passed away. The fact that he's including this here, I have no doubt, is 100% intentional.
A little dig.
It's not, I don't think it's a dig. It's only a dig against the people who think he's still alive.
Right, exactly.
But he's making a point. This, by the way, there's a lot of politics involved saying Zatzal. Because when you say Zechar Tzadik Livracha, do you include Tzadik? So if like a rabbi passes away that you don't want to give, I think you'll say Zechron Livracha and you take away Tzadik. There's a lot of like subtle politics here. And I'm sure someone who isn't me can do a very nice dissertation on the use of Zechar Tzadik Livracha and when it's used, when it's not used, and how it's used. Here, I have no doubt, and I, even though I'm not a mind reader, I haven't spoken to David Berger about this in particular, I have no doubt that him including Zatzal here is 100% intentional. Yeah, an advertisement appeared.
An advertisement appeared in the Jewish press declaring that he would be resurrected as the Messiah. At that point, I wrote a letter containing the following assertion. There is no more fundamental messianic belief in Judaism than the conviction that the Davidic Messiah who appears at the end of days will not die before completing his mission.
Okay. Sharon, take number 18.
Though the belief that the Rebbe is the Messiah is itself a repudiation of a fundamental Jewish doctrine, at this point it is only the beginning. We now confront an incredible reality which has surged beyond the confines of false messianism and the mere affirmation of a second coming. A process which developed over decades, even generations, in Christianity and the 17th century movement of the messianic pretender Shabtai Tzvi is unfolding with blinding speed in Lubavitch messianism. To a historian, this is a gripping drama, the opportunity not of one lifetime but of many. To a believing Jew, it is a bizarre rerun of a nightmare. The Lubavitch Rebbe is becoming God.
And we've seen some sources that back that up. At the end of the day, right, if we're trying to set up a formula in terms of why, I mean, Dr. Berger was very explicit when he said, establish the principle anyone who proclaims the messiahship of the Rebbe stands outside the parameters of Orthodox Judaism. Question, based on these sources, and these were some of the best I could find, how? Why is believing that the Rebbe, you know, is the Messiah, at least based on here, he says here, there's no more fundamental messianic belief in Judaism. The conviction of Davidic Messiah who appears at the end of day will not die before completing his mission. That's point one. And he says that the belief that the Rebbe is Messiah is a repudiation of a fundamental Jewish doctrine. My question for people here, open question, can go around if you'd like. Do you think that what do you think of Dr. Berger's core argument? And, well, first off, in terms of, I'll tell you how I read it. If you see it as something else, please add in corrections. My understanding is that, according to Dr. Berger, they are no longer Orthodox because their theology about the Messiah seems to parallel or be more in line with Christianity. Now, by specifically the Messiah, for those who say the Rebbe is God or some form of divinity, I think most people here, if you just say if any person is divine, has no issue that saying that's already beyond the pale. But that's also not exactly what he said. That's a certain extreme that leads you to idolatry, and he actually uses that term. But he says here, again, anyone who proclaims the messiahship of the Rebbe, right? So even before getting, you know, not even reaching that level of saying that he's divine, he's saying that the saying that the Rebbe is Mashiach after he died, that he has to be resurrected to complete his mission, puts you beyond the pale of Orthodox Judaism. And the reason, as far as I see it, is because it is more in line with Christian sources and not in line with, as he put it here, the criteria always deemed necessary for confident identification of the Messiah. What do you think? Are you convinced by it, not convinced by it, by his argument?
Yes, but I also wonder if the notion of Schneerson as being the Messiah existed outside of the Lubavitch, and they pose as any kind of threat to the rest of Judaism. I mean, certainly Satmar and the other Lubavitch.
Satmar doesn't care about Chabad. Yeah, they
don't care.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why, as an academic, I can understand studying it.
Yeah.
But to care that they have these particular notions, I mean, I would suspect that it would die out after a generation or two.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't understand why, outside of the studying them as a group and their beliefs, is all that terribly important.
So I would guess. I mean, it could very well be that the messianic rhetoric will die out in a generation or two. I mean, die out completely. Again, not being Chabad, I don't know. What you seem to be asking is, why does he need to say this? Like, if they're just blank, then just throw it out. I think there are a couple of reasons. One is Chabad, not only back then, but today, is incredibly prolific and influential. Chabad will go to places that no other Jews will go. And as such, you know, a lot of people become observant through Chabad, let's say college campuses. For one example,
Mumbai.
Exactly. Now, the reason why you would want to delegitimize this element, at least, is let's say you're out in the University of Wisconsin, right? There's a Chabad rabbi there, and the Chabad rabbi is preaching messianism. Right? What do you do with that? And this is what the person thinks of it. Now, I should give a disclaimer. I don't know if there is a Chabad at the university. Yeah,
there is.
Okay? I have no idea who that person is, let alone if he's a messianist. Okay? I'm giving that as just one example. Do not you know, say that I'm saying this guy's a messianist. I have no idea. Important for me to throw in the disclaimer, but I think that's the reason why. Or, again, because we've already accepted Chabad, then maybe this idea could be perpetrated. I mean, don't forget, if you're talking about idolatry within a midst of the Jewish people, which, you know, certainly with the divinity part is, you can see why people would want to stop that. And as we, you know, in subsequent future weeks, we're going to discuss, like, complaints against conservative and reform or other denominations and the like. You know, you could say people might have thought, oh, it's not really Jewish, they're not really a threat to us, they're going to die out in a couple of years. There was seen as a clear and present danger in the present to have an element within Judaism that says the Rebbe, not just that the Rebbe is Mashiach, but the idea that the Rebbe can, that the Mashiach can die and be resurrected, as so according to him, is so fundamentally against all things Jewish that it has to be discredited immediately. Not unlike if someone gets up in Judaism and says, you know, I'm now going to worship an umbrella, you know, and this is your God. Yeah, any thoughts on Berger's argument?
I have too many to make anything coherent, except one minor point.
Okay.
I wonder, at the beginning of Christianity, well, all right, what I think is going on is that in Berger's mind, there is a black and white. There's Judaism and there's Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And to him, this is too close to Christianity. So it's like they're on the wrong side. They're our enemy. They're siding with the communists.
And that point of demarcation is specifically that the Messiah has to be resurrected in order to complete its mission.
Yeah. Now, what I wonder about is when Christianity began, was it so clear at that point? Were the positions so crystallized?
No pun intended.
That it,
sorry.
Oh, that it was equally clear in those days that that particular belief put them outside of the pale, or was it perhaps subject to debate at that point?
A wonderful question, because you could argue that Jewish theology was also, you know, working its way out. I mean, certainly happened long before Rambam, and in the parts that I actually cited but we didn't read aloud here, Rambam actually responds in particular to Jesus of Nazareth, so you're free to read ahead to that. Any thoughts on Berger's argument?
But personally, we are, there's also a thread in he's called normative Judaism that, you know, don't worry too much about the philosophy, do them at source.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have a group of people who, at least from the outside, appear to be doing them at source.
Mm-hmm.
Although when you tell me they have a different Shulchan Aruch,
well, there is something called Shulchan Aruch HaRav, you know, that they would sooner follow the halacha, which, again, we could argue, like, from a pure halachic standpoint, are they consistent with halacha? But at least they give enough lip service to it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, any deviations that they may make in Jewish law are not going to be that much greater than you find in any other Jewish community.
Okay. Which leads me to another point. If they are messianists,
yeah,
in this way, what happens? Do they say the Aleinu? Do they have a different Aleinu? I mean, I would look at it kind of like a checklist.
Well, Ed said that they actually insert different things. I haven't seen a Chabad sitter, so I don't know. They don't. Okay, there you go. So the first point you raised, though, is that normally we define, in terms of who's beyond the pale, not based on bad theology, but based on incorrect actions. I think that's a very crucial point, which we're going to get back to. Dana?
The messianists are a small but very vocal minority, and I imagine that they just make better coffee. So, I think that they're hyped more, and because they're hyped a lot, there's a perception that a large percentage of Chabad believes this.
Okay.
And
about rejecting the messianists, whether or not they're big or small,
yeah,
right? Again, tabling that question.
Okay, fine.
But in terms of marginalizing the messianic element.
Oh, absolutely.
So you're convinced by Berger, and because
I didn't need to be convinced by Berger.
Okay.
It was wrong before he wrote the book.
There you go. Ed, any thoughts?
Me, I got an anecdote. I was in Crown Heights, and Ellie Cohn, who's some rabbi of Chabad, said, oh, they're lining up, the Rebbe's giving out dollar bills. figured, well, what the hell, I'll check it out.
Sure, free money.
So I stood online, finally got to the front, and he gives me the dollar, but he's got a bodyguard next to him. And I say, you're supposed to have a connection upstairs, and maybe you can pull a couple of strings. The bodyguard said, next.
Well, that's, yeah.
I shook his hand.
Probably gets that a lot.
I shook his hand also. And some guys later on, I said, you shook his hand? He shook your hand? I say, I shook his hand. What's the big deal? You know. So anyway, I was annoyed that the guy made me go next. So I took the dollar, and within their view, I stuck it in the tzedakah can. They probably figure I'm supposed to hold it for the rest of my life as a holy relic, but say what I mean.
I can't speak for the University of Wisconsin, but at City College, the last 3-4 years, Chabad has been on campus.
Okay.
And I have never heard the Rabbi talk about Shneason as being Mashiach,
mm-hmm.
not even about, he has mentioned Mashiach when Mashiach comes in,
mm-hmm.
but never in, that would be outside the context of normative.
Yeah, he's not with, that guy.
Well, I don't know that, look, I've also had one teacher say there are two types of Chabads. There are those who say he's Mashiach and those who believe he's Mashiach. You know, I don't, again, no idea if that's true, but as I stated earlier, the messianic rhetoric has definitely been toned down since the time of this book. That is, I think, just from my cursory view. From my own... Yeah,
it came out in the second printing in paperback.
Yeah. I mean,
so it might build the fire up a little more.
Possibly. I don't know. Again, not Chabad. My own sense is kind of like what Sharon was saying in terms of when you're going to pick a fight with the Messianic Chabad over this particular point, under the grounds that you have an ideology, the ideology seems to be more consistent with Christianity than Judaism. Not only that, but, you know, this was a core, for many years, was the core differentiation between Judaism and Christianity, and therefore ought to be excluded. What I would suggest is that that's not so much a halachic argument, but a social argument. Reason is this. As we saw a couple of weeks ago, there have been plenty of times where Christian ideas became assimilated into Judaism. One example that I gave here, I actually did for a paper in my own class with Dr. Berger about esoteric knowledge, where the idea that the rabbis don't actually teach halacha on their own, but rather the Spirit of God comes down and speaks through them, was initially in Tertullian, several generations before it was repeated, or at least summarized very closely.
I'm sorry, it was what before it was?
It was an idea found in the writings of Tertullian, one of the church fathers. The idea that the rabbis, that, or at least in his words, the priests, don't make decisions, but rather the Spirit of God speaks through them. And then Ramban, Nachmanides, said something pretty much identical. Right? So if you're talking about, you know, this is wrong because it's something copied from Christianity, well, what about everything else? And when I wrote the paper for, you know, Berger, it was actually kind of interesting. And it didn't affect my grade, but I was writing basically about, you know, Christian influences on Nachmanides, which is seems to be odd considering that he, you know, he, for what we've recalled, has one of the most well-known vikuachs, or responses, disputations against the Christians, and yet there's certain ideas that he happens to follow. He wrote that the paper was, quote, well-researched, well-argued, unconvincing, and offensive. And to quote my father's Rebbe, Chacham Yosef Ba'ur, told me that he loved the book on Chabad. And I told him about the thing with Ramban. And he said, if that's his opinion on Ramban, his book makes no sense. The reason being, and I think one of the reasons why it's important to make this distinction is, when you're talking about the politics of exclusion, and you're saying that this is the point that sets you beyond the pale, it means tacitly you're saying everything else is okay. Meaning all of the Vilna Gaon's remarks against Hasidut in general are, you know, fine. We disagree with him. We think he's wrong. Because otherwise, Dr. Berger should, you know, trash all of Hasidut, not just Chabad, but Hasidism in general. It means that any other theological element of Kabbalists, right, that happened for years ago, and we can, you know, discuss where exactly this came from, you know, Kabbalistic thought, for him, it was already part of what we would consider Jewish tradition, for lack of a better term, and by Jewish tradition I mean opinions that were well accepted by the Jewish community. It is thus the reason why I'm making that distinction is it's not a halachic argument as much as a social one. As there are certain ideas, yes, even though we might have gotten it from Christianity, whether or not you admit it, are things that, well, we've already tacitly accepted it as such. And especially for him, given how much time he spent studying the Middle Ages, the belief that the Messiah would have to die and be resurrected was so antithetical to what it meant to be Jewish and to be associated Jewish and to be affiliated Jewish. That was your boundary line, certainly in the Middle Ages, between being Jewish and being Catholic. So for him, you can understand why having one idea that appears in Christianity too is enough to put you beyond the pale of social orthodoxy. Now, even just having that thought, having that mentality, even if it doesn't translate into different halakhic practices, even if there are a whole lot of other theologically questionable ideas that have become, quote, accepted, this is one issue that for him is where you set the boundary lines. And here there's a bit of subjectivity. You could make an argument, and I'm sure people have, that just as the Vilna Gaon tried rejecting all of Hasidut, you could find other reasons for rejecting all of Hasidut, not just on this issue. The fact that Dr. Berger picks this issue to the exclusion of every other one, and by every other one, I mean, let's say, every other theological issue, is, I think, telling in its own right. And in some ways, it says a little bit more about Dr. Berger and where he's coming from, as opposed to what does it objectively mean to be Jewish. It's just today, you know, we can ask these questions a lot more because it's so contemporary, we could ask him directly. But it's something I think that's very worth considering. At least that's just my two cents on it. Yeah.
I'm sure Berger would have a better response than I do.
Hmm?
But my response is yes, but this one belief is at the center of Christianity and uniquely Christian.
Mm-hmm.
The belief that our officials, be they priests or rabbis, are divinely inspired could be almost any religion.
But it doesn't appear in Torah. It only comes into Jewish sources after it came up in other religions. Torah Sheba'al Peh, not only does it not say anything of that nature, it rejects it explicitly.
Doesn't it make rabbis prophets if God speaks through them?
In a sense, yes. It's how you get divine infallibility. And there are people today, we gave an example here of someone who actually poskin based on rabbinic infallibility on that very reason, which Dr. Berger's not going to get up and say, you can't say that because it's Christian, or at least he hasn't to date. He certainly hasn't written a book about it. Yeah?
So how do we reconcile the concept of Ruach HaKodesh with with this discussion?
I don't see where there's a question.
A lot of people said Rashi had Ruach HaKodesh.
And therefore? First off, there's no way for you to know.
No.
Right? So let's say you even say that he did. Therefore what?
You just said it was against Judaism.
Well, to say that someone had Ruach HaKodesh means someone is divinely inspired, right? There's nothing wrong with saying someone, even if you assume someone is divinely inspired. The part that I said would be against Judaism would say because of his divine inspiration, he's not only infallible, but you're not allowed to question him, or questioning this rabbi is like questioning God himself. You know, there's a huge difference between that. You know, huge, huge jump. But one of the reasons why I wanted to, you know, why I underlined this, because he says here the criteria always deemed necessary for confident identification of Messiah. The fact that he says always deemed necessary, by whom? Right? If that's going to be your criteria also, that this is beyond the pale of Judaism, well, how did you get to that decision? We had no Sanhedrin Paskin. Right? No court said, here is exactly what has to happen to the exclusion of everything else. Right? Yes, we might have not have sources to the contrary, but here's where the Rambam thing comes in handy, where the Rambam admits we don't necessarily know what's going to happen. Berger's basis for saying that it's beyond the pale of Judaism was simply because Jews have never done it this way. And it's an identifiable innovation that you know this is going to come up. To give a parallel here, and I think this is the difference between whether or not an idea has been socially accepted as legitimate versus something new. When I was in Rav Tellner's shul many years ago, the question came up, someone, I guess, said, you need to have brown matzahs on Pesach. Nazis need to be brown. And to quote Rip Tendler on this, or at least as best as I can from memory, he said, you know, he understands there are a lot of Humras that came up over the generations. But if it happened 250 years ago, all right, fine, it's been accepted. We assume that they're good people. But the ones who are saying we need brown matzot, I know they're amaratza. I know they're ignorant, and we can dismiss them accordingly. And I think that's a very crucial distinction to make here as well, in that since it is something new, right, it's much easier to rebut something that's new as it's coming up, like the Vilna Gaon and Chassidut in general, and Berger and the Messianist element in Chabad, than to go after things that have already been, for lack of a better term, assimilated by Jewish people. I get that a lot here in matters of halakha, when I say, well, this seems to be Jewish law, and people say, well, we don't do that. But the assumption isn't that halakha is determined by law, it's determined by culture. And it seems to me that's a large part of Dr. Berger's argument, but it makes, in a way, a bit of sense, given the dynamics about how exclusion is going to come up, especially when you have a new innovation. Well, I guess all innovations are new, but a new theology or some new group that comes up.
Where right? does he expect the relationship between modern Orthodoxy and Hasidim to evolve? Or how do you see their relationship?
I would have to ask him. Speculation, based on what I've read, is that when he says, you know, they're beyond, outside the parameters of Orthodox Judaism, must be treated accordingly, it would mean you can't count them in minyan. By them, I mean, again, those who advocate that the Rebbe is Mashiach after he died, not Chabad in general. So if someone does that, according to my guess is, you wouldn't count them in minyan, you couldn't give them an aliyah, you couldn't eat their shechita, and you would basically treat them as, you know, he doesn't actually say it's not Jewish. He just says beyond the parameters of Orthodox Judaism, which you could say is an interesting loaded term in terms of how does he handle Reform, Conservative, or other Reconstructionists. True, but I think his point is you treat them as beyond the pale. And now, whether or not you treat that, it's an interesting point there. He doesn't say you treat them as not Jewish, it's just they're beyond the pale of Orthodox Judaism, which is also lends me to think it's less of a halachic argument, but more of a social one. I don't recall where in the book he actually defined that. It would be an interesting question, which I guess you're free to ask him. I know one of Dr. Berger's great qualities is he is very responsive to emails and questions, more than most people. At any rate, that is, in a nutshell, this, the class here. You'll notice the last section here not only gives the bibliographic information for Dr. Berger's book, if you want to read it. I also included here some links to critiques and responses to Berger's book, in that not everyone went by it. You're free to read those and to evaluate, are they actually responding to Berger's argument? Because I know that there were some people who said, oh, Berger's just Chabad bashing, which I don't think is true. He's not bashing Chabad, he's bashing Messianic Chabad. Big distinction there. But I encourage people to do reading. One of them includes one of Berger's responses to the criticism of David Singer, and a few other very interesting books about how Chabad operates. One is The Rebbe's Army by Sue Fishkoff, which is a great ethnography on how Chabad operates. And in the introduction, she raises some of the issues of the Messianic, raises some of Berger's issues. She doesn't pick sides, because the point is, how does Chabad answer them? So, you know, that's something to consider there. And finally, Elliot Wilson's book, Open Secret, which talks about Messianic theology throughout Chabad. It is a wonderful work. It's one of the best academic works I've seen on Chabad. And the first two chapters alone are just phenomenal in terms of research models. I should also point out, I don't get a cut for any book I recommend. These are things, if this is a topic that interests you, highly recommend that people go on ahead. And I guess, to conclude, may we all, not even quite sure how to phrase this, but, like the Mashiach or unlike the Mashiach, I ask you all to come again. See you next week. We're going to be discussing in subsequent classes more halachic responses dealing with us versus them attitudes from, more recent contemporary periods. All right? Have a wonderful week.